Here is one of a series of talks by spiritual leader Lola McDowell Lee, spanning two decades from the early 70s through the 90s. Lola was a Zen Roshi, whose Rinzai lineage included Dr. Henry Plutov and renowned Zen master Shigetsu Sasaki. Lola was a religious scholar as well as an ordained Christian minister. While the talks are focused mainly on Zen and Buddhism, Lola drew on many spiritual traditions, including those of Jesus, Plato, Lao Tzu, the Hindu Vedas, Meister Eckhart, and Gurdjieff.
So, well, I hope you all feel that you benefited somewhat from your excursion into a world within. And it's too bad it has to end, but it does, and we can do it again. And we say the same thing every time. If I have it for 2 weeks, that's a bit much. But I think it was an exceptionally fine sit this time. Some of you benefited greatly, but there were times when it was more as if there were instead of just a group of people, you know, many walking around or milling around, it was sometimes more like there was one force with lots of appendages. So that you conducted yourself well by getting out of the way. And I think it was great. So now we can pick up from there and see what you do with it. Yes? Okay. The thing is, sitting over a period of time like that, even though one thinks one has not accomplished maybe what they would have liked to have accomplished, but sitting over a period of time like that, it one is seated differently. And even though we cover that over again with being out in the mundane world, it does not leave. There is a different, I can call it as a seatedness. And I hope you're aware of it. Okay, is there anything else I have to talk about? Announcements? You mean a 3-day sit?
No. Friday and Saturday?
No, I don't think so.
Okay.
We've done had it.
But we will sit tomorrow night.
We will sit tomorrow night and we'll sit on Wednesday.
Right.
Okay. But the other, I think we can forego it considering I think it would be such a aftermath that, you know, even though you say, well, you just got started and you'd like to sit another week, comes the prospect of sitting overnight. See, so 1 week is sufficient. Anything else? Seems to me I'm forgetting something. Seems to me there's some kind of announcement I should be making. Randy never came back for his table?
No.
Yeah, and stayed here until when? Almost before this summer session.
Before
he could have just he could have just as well left it
left
there.
It.
Yeah. If you happen to see him again, would you?
I'll remind him. Yeah.
Yeah, and of
the
book.
The book too.
Okay.
Right.
Hmm?
Breathing. About the breath.
But yeah. Now, it's sort of in with what was going on here last week. This little story of the monk, you know, he went to the fair. You're familiar with the story. And he went to his roshi and asked if he could take some of the monks over to the fair. And he was given permission. And because he said it would be an opportunity for some practical teaching. And when they got there, instead of milling around, he went straight over to the shooting gallery, and he, you know, the rest of the monks had to go with him. And there were lots of prizes there for a bullseye. And as this monk and his all the other monks appeared there, the townspeople got rather curious, and they gathered around. And the monk himself now took the bow and three arrows. And of course everybody wondered what he was going to do, and so a kind of a tension started. And some of them were muttering to themselves, you know, that surely this time now he had overreached himself, because surely he couldn't hit any targets. And he turned to the people around and to the other monks, and he says, study me attentively. And he flexed the bow, placed the arrow in it, you know, and shoved his bamboo hat back on to the back of his head. And he took a very careful aim, and he, you know, and the arrow went very wide of its mark. So, and there was a lot of laughter in the crowd, huh? But the monks, they didn't. They kind of stirred uneasily. After all, if he's going to show off, he might as well do something decent instead of missing. Huh? So the monk turned, you know, and he looked at them, and he faced them, and he says, silence. He says, don't you know this is a demonstration of how a soldier shoots, you know? He's very often wide of the mark. That's why he loses wars, you know? And at the moment when I let the arrow loose, I was identified as a soldier. I said to myself, I am a soldier firing at the enemy, and whoops, it goes over there. So he picked up the second arrow, and he slipped it into the bow, and he let the second arrow go, and it fell very short. It was sort of only halfway to the target, see? And now this time, nobody said anything. There was this dead silence. But he turned to all these people, these town people, and he says, now you've seen the shot of a man who was too eager, who, having failed the first time, is now too nervous to concentrate. And so the arrow falls short. Well, now even the stall holder was getting intrigued with these explanations, and he started to really listen, and everybody began to pay attention. And the monk now nonchalantly turned to the target, and he aimed, and he let the arrow fly, and it hit the very center of the bullseye. Right on. Yeah. So, and very deliberately then, he looked over all the prizes, and he picked out the one he wanted, and he started to walk away. And then there was this clamor that broke out on all these people. You know, blah, 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 blah. He couldn't hear what they were saying for everybody talking at once. You know how that goes. So he said to them, silence, you know. Let one of you ask what seems to be bothering all the rest of you. And for a little moment, nobody spoke, and there was this quietness again. And then one little yokel shuffled forward, and he said, we want to know which of you fired the third shot. And he says, that? Oh, that was me. Isn't that fit in? I thought it fit in with what I've been yapping about all week. Be here. Okay? It is written that the Buddha said, I consider the dignities of kings and lords as a particle of dust that floats in the sunbeam. I consider the treasure of precious metals and stones as bricks and pebbles. I consider the gaudy dress of silks and brocades as a worn-out rag. I consider this universe as small as a whole lila fruit. I consider the lake of Anavatapatya as a drop of oil with which one smears the feet. I consider the various methods of salvation taught by the Buddhas as a treasure created by the imagination. I consider the transcendental doctrine of Buddhism as a precious metal or priceless fabric seen in a dream. I consider the teaching of Buddhas as a sky flower before my eyes. I consider nirvana as awakening from a daydream or a nightmare. I consider the struggle between heterodox and orthodox as the antics of the six mythical dragons. I consider the doctrine of sameness as the absolute ground of reality. Now, to help people everywhere to become free of, the shackles of the outer world, that is, orthodox and whatever. In order to free ourselves of our encumbrances that we have been taught and that we have acquired, the Buddha teaches an inner discipline. Now, once we have learned the ways of the inner discipline, he's there, ready to destroy that also. You know, either we are ruled from out there, society, or we are ruled from within, or we are free. If we are ruled from without, we are a slave. If we are ruled from within, we are still a slave. And so this is then what Vivekananda, you know, in his poem wrote about. And he says, strike off thy fetters. Bonds that bind thee down, of shining gold, or darker, baser ore, love, hate, good, bad, and all the dual throng. No slave is slave, caressed or whipped, not free. For fetters, though of gold, are not less strong to bind. Then off with them, sannyasin bold, you know. Say, om, tatsat, om. That particular verse or in that whole poem shows a tremendous understanding. Now, Now, we have a discipline, and most traditions do have a discipline, in order to step out from under the yoke or the domination of the masses, our culture or society or however you want to put it. You do know what I mean. We do understand that there are certain rules by which one must conduct themselves, and we do it, but we are not dominated by it. There's a difference. Understanding and doing because it is necessary, or being dominated by it. Now, once you are free of the outer domination, then there is this inner domination that has to be dealt with. For we can use this inner discipline, or, you know, as a very subtle form of slavery. So we should gear ourselves to being here, to be very present, to act as the form of the formless. When one acts, this form, you know, is of the formless, then there is a certain grace in the act. And there is a kind of a benediction even for yourself, because the actor has gone. I know that some of you, the way you conduct yourselves, it's very mechanical, and it's shh, 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 you know, because it's so practiced, and because you're so doing it. And there isn't much benefit that way. You know, when the actor is gone, there is this form of what is hidden, the formless. So there is doing being, or being doing. You know, and being, of course, is not just some big something, man. Now, if you're always trying to discipline yourself, which we do start out to do, you know, we start out disciplining. But if you're always trying to discipline yourself, there is this doer that is in here, and that part of you disciplines the other part of you. And then it shifts around, and this part is disciplining this part. See? And gradually one part becomes a master over the other part. And we still have this master-slave thing. It's a division. And this is duality. There's no oneness about it. And of course, in such a thing, look at the conflict. Look at the tension. Part of me says, do this, and part of me says, the heck with it. You know? In a duality, there's always a conflict. And then you've got this little voice that says this, then you've got this little voice that says that. To whom does the voice belong? Who is trying to rule whom? Who is being dominated by what? And yet we must begin with a discipline. And the discipline is to sit down and to be there, to be here, and to shut up, you know, so that a stillness can come about. Stillness is not discipline, but oh boy, yeah. Now, it has been said that in Buddhism, there is no God. You know, he said that we go to nirvana and we're blown out. So that in a way, that there is no God as there is in the Western religion, in a way it's true, but in another way it's not true. He did not postulate God as a person. But he did talk about an everlasting light. And of course, we also have that in St. John, that there is an everlasting light. And in Buddhism, there's Amitabha Buddha. The Buddha's idea was, and you know, with all his Hindu background of all these gods and goddesses, there is Krishna, you know, which is a personal god. He comes and plays his little flute, and you follow after him, Pied Piper. If there is a personal god, some image that you have set up in your mind, how can you ever be free? A personal god becomes something like a dictator. You're never left alone. You know, he's everywhere. So you hide in the closet and he's there too. And you know, we are told as children, God is looking at you everywhere. Constantly he's there with you. His eyes are always following you. Well, that leaves me no freedom, and it certainly doesn't leave me any privacy. I mean, to have this man always following me around. If I believed that, I could never escape from him. But this freedom, which is not just a hedonistic pleasure thing, you know, that I can do as I please. That's not freedom at all. Doesn't even come close. Far away. You know, but to be liberated from all my desires and my ego structure, so that I'm no longer manipulating myself in order to look good. You know, I'm not dominated, you know. Then freedom. And freedom then is God. We put it that way, huh? Moksha, Buddha called it. It's his God. Free, freedom, liberation, emancipation. So that it is a freedom in light, or a freedom in God. And that freedom, then, is in divine. Freedom in divine, huh? And for that kind of freedom, you need to wake up. You need to open your eyes and see, and you need to listen. Because religion shouldn't be out of any fear, you know? When religion says, like ours does, you know, I am very jealous. You can't go anywhere and you can't do anything unless you have my approval. You cannot worship any god other than me. If you do even think about it, I will destroy you. These are political words. They're not religious words. It just simply means, don't move out of this party. Don't move out of this clan. There have been Buddhas existing that have not been jealous. There have been men and women that have existed that have not been jealous. They reached that place, so maybe they seem to be in a better place than God, if he's still jealous. You know, it's a terrible threat. You know, if you don't do as I say, I will punish your children for 10 generations. What a terrible fear to walk around with, huh? And then on the other hand, if you do as I say, I will reward your children for 100 generations. But how do you know which is which? Yeah. So we look at it and we see very readily, you know, that it is a means of keeping the tribes together. Yeah. And it was deemed necessary, and for some it still is. I mean, there are, after all, let's face it, many different states of consciousness. Not everybody can cope with this thing of being free. No. But through it all, we should be explorers. What are you going to explore? Well, you're going to explore yourself, And to explore yourself, you don't need a lot of beliefs. And as a matter of fact, you don't need any. Belief is not a requirement for exploration. I mean, when these people climbed Mount Everest, they explored, and they explored the Arctic, and they explored the Antarctic. What did they need to believe? Only that it was there. So you're there. Aren't you? Or are you somewhere else? I think you're somewhere else this morning. Belief, you know, in some circumstances, you know, is an obstacle. So we doubt. And we ponder. And we contemplate. And then finally we learn what is meditation. Yeah? And when the mind comes to experience truth without any beliefs, then mind is mind only. And it is true. And we have all, I'm pretty sure everybody in this room has had some kind of belief about heaven and hell. Have you? Sure. Some other world we're going to go to someday, which are our projections. Yeah. The Tibetan hell doesn't have any fire in it like ours does. It has more ice, more cold. And the Hindu hell has more heat. I mean, after all, it's a warm country. And their idea then of heaven would be an air-conditioned place that's never too hot, and lots of cool breezes going by, and the shady trees and the flowers are all diamonds. Projections. They're dreams. And the missionaries go to Alaska a long time ago, and they talk to the Eskimos about hell, and the Eskimos were quite ready to go. It's warm. So what do these dreams show? Your mind, your desire. So that now if you stop dreaming and stop trying to create another world in which everything is perfect for you, if you do that in this existence, then there is no heaven and no hell. And this is what the Buddha tried to do, and what all the patriarchs after him tried to do, and what the Zen Roshis thereafter tried to do, you know, is to take everything away, including your heaven and your hell. Unless it is all taken away, the mind just continues with it. I mean, it occupies itself with it. So there comes a saying, you cut to the root of the mind. And you leave not one thing, not even yourself. And certainly not the Buddha. No. And it isn't, you know, in taking all this away, it's not that he's so much against other ideas and other philosophies. He's just as much against his own. That's trueness, huh? Yeah. It's very easy to be against others, you know, but to be against one's own, you know, it simply means one is asserting a truth. Authenticity. Yeah. Using a method and then taking it away, and then use another method and take it away. So you don't cling forever to that method. See, we need methods. You know, it's a big jump. That abyss is, you can't see the other shore. So we take it in small doses. And in order to do this, we have methods. We have contrivances. A koan is a contrivance. Upaya. It's a breathing exercise. It's a device. You know, we use them, but we don't use beliefs. The greatest awareness is to come to this no mind. And you know, a teacher like the Buddha, he had 1,500 monks in this one place. So he would, of course, have many contrivances. You know, 1,500 states of consciousness. And so, and then there was the 227 precepts. You know, they're not for everybody. They're for some. And the contrivance, you know, are for some, because he states and says, this is a method, and everybody runs, oh, you know. It's for me. It is not necessarily. There may be another contrivance is necessary for you. It's like the little monk, you know, he was a very rabid fisherman, and he was chatting with a friend, and the friend said to him, well, I notice that when you talk about the fish that you caught, you know, you vary the size of it for different listeners. And he says, well, yes, of course, I never tell a man more than he can believe. And so with the Buddha, you come to him with a childish mind, and he'll give you some toys to play with. They may be beneficial toys, but they're toys, and the time comes when you leave those toys and go on to others, you know? If you come with a little more understanding, you're a little more grown up and a little more mature, he wouldn't give you those same toys. No. If you come with a truly mature mind, like Abhuti or Sariputra, then no toys at all, but these thundering words in his agamas and his sutras, explanations on these statements. Yeah. And it is written in the Christian Bible, in our Bible, to the effect that Jesus' disciples, he asked him, you know, questions, and one of them was, what is the message of peace that you have brought to the world? And he said, you know, I have not come to bring peace. I bring a sword. And there's a many people have puzzled over this down through the centuries. And many are the answers, of course, that have come to these puzzlements. Here was Jesus. Supposedly, they call him a messenger of peace. And he says that God is love. And we should live in peace together. You love your brother as you love yourself. And then he says, I bring a sword. And he says, bury the dead. Leave them. Leave your mother and father. Give away your riches. follow me. I bring a sword. That's difficult. How are you going to put that all together? That's quite a jigsaw. Every master brings a sword. Understand it, It's to cut to the roots of the mind. Unless you leave your mother and father, you cannot follow me. Now, what do you think that means? That you should move out of the house into a different apartment and never phone them or never write again? I don't think so. But the conditioning that they have given you, leave it. And what society has given us, our ideas of good and our ideas of bad. So to look at the whole conditioning, it takes a sword to cut to the roots of that. And he says, until you do, you cannot follow me. Oh, you can run around on the ground chasing me, but you can't follow me into the kingdom. For that, I must use my sword. The Buddha wasn't any different. And there are times he was very stern in his compassion. He didn't allow any loopholes, from where you could get into your slavery again. So he said, I consider the dignities of kings and lords as a particle of dust that floats in the sunbeam. Well, we've all seen, a sunbeam coming in and all the little dust particles in it. You've all seen that. Yeah. The dignity of kings and lords is brought about by others. It's by show, this elaborate show, and by others taking care of you, by others paying homage to you, so that you wear this cloak of dignity. It's the height of ambition. And they say ambition sees what it wants to see. And usually what that is its own aggrandizement, Or it may see fear of its position. So now to be non-ambitious, and not hankering for down the line, this other world, and who's going to come and bow before you, A non-ambitious mind is a still mind. And you cannot sit there and still your mind. It's an impossibility. Boy, look at all that stuff that's in there, Stillness comes of its own accord out of the depths. It just rises and there it is. And to be in that stillness, to have it rise, as you watch it, you will understand what dignity is. It is the greatest dignity in the world. It's this dignity that comes, all by itself. And you sit there and you look at it. This is happening to me, This rising. And about all you can say of it, it is a dignity of the Lord is present. And it comes from within. Has nothing to do with any other. Has only to do with you. It's just the dignity of being the truth. When the Buddha was a young man, on his way to town one day with his charioteer, he saw a dead body. Up to this time, He'd never known about death. Then he was 18. His father, the king, had been warned never to talk about death because that would set him searching. So they had no death around him. They kept him in the palace grounds and kept him guarded. You know, you all know the story. One day he went out one gate and he saw poverty, and that puzzled him. And one day he went out another gate and he saw illness, and that puzzled him. And then one day he and the charioteer went out another gate and he saw death. What happened to this man? Well, the charioteer has to tell him, you know, and he says that this man died. Is this going to happen to me too? Yes, it's going to happen to you too. And at that moment, this young man had a very great insight. And he left the palace forever. The charioteer went with him. You know, through thick and thin, he went with him. And you know, this question, this death. How? What is this death? What is beyond death? Anything? Is there something there? What am I that comes and goes? And born and died? From whence? To where? Those were his questions. And he went out looking. That's one way of doing it. And there's another way. It's this very wealthy businessman in New York, and he suffered from a nervous breakdown. And the doctor said to him, you must have a rest. You go to Florida, and you lie around under the sun, and you go swimming, and you will be better in a month. Oh, okay. And he did it. He went to Miami. He got into his swimming trunks, and he strolled along the sandy beach. And the water was really too much to resist, so he went in for a dip. But he forgot that it had been many, many years since he'd had any exercise. And before very long, he was out there over his head, you know, and he couldn't swim back. Help! 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 You know. And this very alert lifeguard flung himself into the water and towed him to safety. And this businessman's wife came running, and she says, Irving, are you all right? Speak to me. Are you all right? And Irving is lying there, you know, and he's dripping with water, and he says, I'm all right. I'm all right. But I've got to ask you something in private. So please. So bend down. So the worried, this very worried wife, she stoops over. And she says, yes, Irving, what is it? And he says, tell me, how much do I tip for a thing like this?
You have been with Jack too.
What?
You've been with Jack too.
Well, no, I just want to bring out, here's this man that faced death. And he had not one question about death, only about money. Huh? Yeah. The beam of ambition makes particles shine like diamonds. Yeah. Then he goes on to say, I consider the treasures of precious metals and stones as bricks and pebbles. Well, somebody, somewhere along the line, I read someplace that we have been likened to children playing along the seashore of life and collecting pebbles. So do more than collect pebbles. You know, be here when you collect them. It's no sin to go out and make money. You know, just don't let it obsess you. Other than that, get everything that you can. Yeah. Also, don't be afraid of success. Be successful. Be here. don't be obsessed by the success or the money. Then you can do what you want with it. You're free of it. You can use it. And when you use it, then you have time for friends, and you have time for meditation, and you have time for truth, and you have time for freedom. Everything here is for our use, but you do not own anything. I consider the gaudy dress of silk and brocade as a worn-out rag. I consider this universe as small as a holila fruit. I don't know what a holila fruit is, to be perfectly honest with you, which I am once in a while. You know, supposing one became tremendously aware, you know, it might be that the universe might appear very small. Just think of the state of awareness that would be, huh? And in this universe, if you look at a man's body, he's really very tiny in this universe, huh? If you're going to compare. Yeah. And if you look at his mind, he's really very foolish. But if you look at his consciousness, he's vast. He's immense. And if you look at the mind, you know, then he's wise. We have all of this. In consciousness, in awareness. That's where it's hidden, huh? In yourself, in your own consciousness, you become aware of the boundless, immeasurable. The body does not contain you. You contain the body. But we are very identified with the body rather than consciousness. And so we are, it is said, we have the cart before the horse. Consciousness first, then comes the body. Consciousness last, and no body, but still consciousness. Huh? We identify with this body, and we dress it up, and we put on beautiful clothes, either to exhibit it or to hide it. Make it look beautiful. Make it look precious. But in what does this body reside? You know, a long time ago, there was a Sufi mystic. This is a long time ago. He was captured by a who went out and captured people at those days? Anyway, there we are. Nobody here knows either. Anyway, these captors then wanted to sell him in the slave market. You get a picture? He's this young man, he's healthy, and he's radiant in himself. And these captors are so delighted to have somebody like that, because now they're going to get a good price. So they take him to the market. They're going to sell him. And on the way there, he said to them, I know you're going to sell me, but let me tell you, if you will listen to me, you can get the highest price possible. I know my price. So whenever you are ready to sell me, you just ask me, is the price right? Yeah. You know, they look. What kind of a slave is this, you know? When they had him there, and after a while, a few hours or so, a king comes by, and he sees this man, and he says, that man looks good. I will buy him. I will give you $5,000, or whatever the equivalent of their money was, huh? And the mystic turns to the man, his captors, and he says, wait, this is nothing. This is nothing. Let the right purchaser come. And so they refused it. Hesitantly, but they refused it, you know. And after a little while, a rich man came by, and he offered him $10,000. Boy, they're getting excited now. And they're ready. You know, this is doubled. The mystic stopped him, though. No, he says, wait, don't be foolish. You know, the price is double now, but just wait. You know. And after a little while comes another man, and he offers $15,000. See? And by now, the captors are looking at their slave, you know, with a lot of question marks, you know. And they look at him. Each time a person comes by and makes an offer, they look at him and say, now? No, not now. Wait. Another man comes by, made a better offer. And finally, you know, toward the end of the day, a man came along and offered $50,000. You know, huge sum of money. And this slave says, wait. You know, and dusk came, and the market was closing down. It was getting pretty deserted, and people were hurrying home. And there was a little man coming by, and he had a bundle of straw on his back. And the captor said to the slave, well, there doesn't seem to be anybody left here. We're going to have to wait now until next week. Wait, said this slave. Ask this man. And that man said, all I have to give anybody is this bundle of straw. I just don't have anything else. And this slave says, that's the right price. Sell now. You know? And these poor captors, you know, they begin to think we got a madman. You know, we lost $50,000, and he wants us to take a bundle of straw. What do you think this slave was showing him? It's not just a little story, you know. We are identified. And to this man, we are identified with a bundle of straw. Or, as the Buddha said, with a bag of skin. Now, if you're identified with the mind rather than the body, you have got a little more freedom. You can certainly wander around better. But, you know, the mind is foolish. You know, oh, my foolish mind, you have dragged me around so far. You know that old thing. What does it know about truth? It just goes on guessing. Boy, doesn't it? So, now, the thing is, stop guessing and get ready to know yourself. Just get ready to know yourself. And now, may the peace and the power that passeth all understanding hold us and keep us in the love of the Christed consciousness while we are seemingly separate one from another. And I do thank you very much.
If you find Lola's talks valuable, more will be posted in weeks to come.